Accession number 23812, Mill 11.
Mr. Doyle, Rail 11. We were talking about the conditions in the goods trucks that you were in on the journey into Thailand. If you could tell us what it was like.
The metal goods trucks, yes. Well, as I've just said, there was 30 of us to each truck. We had nothing to sit on other than the metal floor. During the daytime on that very, very slow journey up the Malay Peninsula, with the sun bearing down, one can imagine the sun bearing on metal. And thank heavens that the door, we were allowed to keep the door open. But it was absolutely stifling and red hot in there, and I couldn't tell you exactly what the temperature was. But the perspiration ran off us. Most unfortunately, there were no toilet facilities, and there were some in the trucks who had dysentery. And one can imagine that not being able to go to the toilet, we tried to get the chaps and hold on to their arms as we would go along into the tram, as they leant over their backsides over the outside of the truck and with the diarrhoea and that sort of thing running from them. But some couldn't hold it, and therefore in there those trucks become a living hell. This was for a matter of about 6 days. Now, en route in those trains, after several hours' travel, I can't tell you the exact duration of that, the trains would stop, and we were allowed out of the trucks, and they would bring buckets of water from some of the sidings there, of which there were these water pipes, and we were able to drink and quench our thirst there. They would also, at certain times of the day, we would stop and at certain destinations, and in wooden buckets they would bring this cooked rice, of which we consumed with what utensils we had got. This was a very slow progress. The trains were as that some of the bridges, etc., had been blown up in Malaya itself. Improvised bridges had been set up, very precarious, I must say, wooden types of structure, and the trains would go slowly over this. This kept the speed down of the trains, and therefore, because of the slowness of speed, very little air was getting into the trucks, and it was absolutely airless. And in these conditions, we were very fortunate enough, to the majority of us, to survive. I don't know of any who didn't survive, not myself personally, but I understand that there were some who didn't.
What was it like at night?
The officers, I think, as far as I can gather, travelled in that train in relative comfort to other ranks.
What was it like at night?
Now, as you've just asked me the question, and I haven't explained what happened in the daytime, the nights were extremely cold. They were ice cold at night. And one can imagine that if one was exposed to very high temperatures and with perspiration running from you, what happened when the nights cooled off? It was absolutely like being in an icebox. And we were not allowed to leave those trucks. We still had to remain in. The different areas and scenario that we were passing through in Malay, there were jungle-type greenery and that as we passed along on these lions. We had no idea where we were, of course. Who was to tell us where we were? We just knew we were in Malay. And that was a journey which lasted, as far as I recall, around about 6 days until we reached our eventual destination. As we approached Thailand, we came into a completely different terrain. If one could relate the terrain there to Lincolnshire in England, you could say they were very much the same, with the exception that being extremely flat, it was extremely flat at that particular part of Thailand, and there was many, many areas of paddy fields, and the rice fields, of course. We saw Thai people with their cattle in these rice fields, and it all looked like something out of a different world. This is as we were in Thailand. I think that took us a considerable length of time going through that part of Thailand until we reached our destination. When we reached our destination...
What was your destination?
Pardon?
What was your destination?
Our destination was a place, a camp called Ban Pong, which is spelt B-A-N-P-O-N-G. Now, that was our first experience of the Japanese Red Cross camp. It was a terrible place. There were chaps there, some of our own chaps who had gone up before us, sick and dying in this camp. It was mostly underwater. The bamboo structures, of which were split bamboo, in which they laid on as beds, were there. These chaps laid there, many of them dying. It was a filthy place. There was excretia in the water. It was a terrible place. And so we had to settle down in a place like that for a period of time, a week or two, until we were to continue to further destinations.
Did anything happen while you were at Ban Pong?
Well, other than the fact that, as I've already explained, that Ban Pong was certainly not the place to go to and expect to be a holiday camp or anything of the like, or indeed a Red Cross camp, because this is exactly what the Japanese had fooled everybody whilst we were at Singapore, that we were going to a place where there was Red Cross camps, etc., etc. But one must remember at this particular point when I say that, that they were not signatories of the Geneva Convention, and as such they were not tied in any way to humane aspects of war, irrespective of what part of the world this could take place. So therefore, in some ways, we were fairly naive, in as much as we looked upon the Japanese, in the first instance anyway, as people who would comply with the humanitarian side of things, which of course I will relate as we go along, that this was not the case in any way. They were completely different in thought, in respect of life itself. It was completely alien to them, our way of thinking, as indeed vice versa. So there we go then. We will now, after being at Ban Pong for a period of probably a week, 2 weeks, I can't remember. But I can't remember anything. My memory is vague in as much as the place is concerned, other than what I've already described. We were then told at that particular junction that in no way was it going to be a prisoner of war camps run by the Red Cross. We found that to be a sense of humour, which we are devoid of that type of sense of humour when it comes to the humanitarian side of things. So we were then told that we were to build a railway. We were not told exactly what the railway would be, what it entailed or anything else. And so we went along on the assumption that we would be treated possibly in a decent way, which was far from the case. We were then rounded up from the camp, and we were told that we were to continue to march to a place called Cambaree.
What were conditions like on the march?
On this particular march, we had no idea what the distance would be, whether it was about a mile or so, or what it would be. But when I've just been asked a question as to what the conditions were in relation to that march, I can only relate to the fact that it was pretty terrible. Because as I've already stated, there were many sick men at that particular period of time, many with suffering from malnutrition and also dysentery, and they were in quite a weakened state. But being in a weakened state meant nothing to the Japanese, as we found as we continued through our prisoner of war life. And during this particular march, which wasn't a march in the sense of being in formation or anything, it was simply a long string of people trundling along with guards at the side. And as we went along at a reasonably leisurely pace, I suppose, after a period of time, we were told that we could rest, which was fortunate because, as I've already said, the weak state of many of the men was such that it was difficult to do otherwise on a continuous march. So as we progressed and men began to suffer, so some of them collapsed, and then we would help our friends as best as we could along this route, and the efforts of us helping them, of course, exhausted ourselves. In no way was this received with any sympathy by the Japs, who would simply come along and shout and rave and hit out at people with their rifles or their fists. And I do know that some chaps, because there was quite a considerable amount of us on this march, one didn't know those who had fell by the wayside. We never did know exactly what the outcome was, because one feel that they were either shot because they were too weak to continue, or they were taken somewhere else. I can't verify exactly what did happen. So after many hours of this march, we eventually came, many miles, we eventually came to this place, Cambaree. We were allowed to rest there for an hour or so, and then after that we were allowed to continue still at a reasonably leisurely pace, and we arrived what was to be my camp for a considerable period of time. And of course that camp was called Tabakan, and was to be the site of where the infamous bridge of the River Kwai still stands.
What were your first impressions of the camp when you arrived?
My first impressions of the camp was not a camp as such. We We rested there at this particular camp, an open space, where there was the odd hut there. And evidently, as it turned out, we were to make a camp as such for a considerable number of prisoners of war. In other words, we were in effect, one could say, an advance party, I suppose. So we were put to work, clearing scrubland and trees and that sort of thing, and clearing quite a large area which was to become our domain for quite a considerable length of time. The type of hut that we built, and other huts that were built all the way along that line, consisted of bamboos, of which there was the bamboo uprights. There were, incidentally, I might add, at this particular time, there were one or two of the natives there to teach us how to build these huts, because they were very adept at that type of thing. No way was there any metal or nails or anything of the like was in the construction of those huts. It was purely and simply bamboo, uprights, horizontal, etc., etc., and they were quite long huts. I can't give you a measurement as such, but they were of considerable length. Now, inasmuch as the roofs of these huts, all the way along the line, was concerned, the actual roof, to protect one from the elements, were what was called attap leaves. I think they're probably from the palms, I don't know, but they're called attap leaves. They're quite big leaves, and we soon became quite skillful in a way, I suppose one could say, in constructing these huts.
How did you do it then?
Pardon?
Can you take us through the stages of it then?
On the stages. Well, the stage, of course, in the first place, no foundation was obviously needed, just so long as the earth was level. It was the Thais, which I don't mean the Thai people, I'm referring to the Thais of which we tied the bamboos together. And that itself, I don't know quite what it was, but it was obviously strips of some sort of bark substance from trees which had been dried, and was quite strong. One can equate it in some ways to the raffia that we use in England in our gardens and greenhouses, etc. And we would tie the bamboos together with these particular bark substances. That was the construction. There were cross members, of course, from pole to pole, which were tied from pole to pole, a bamboo pole, and obviously that was the door. We then, obviously, in the huts, we had to sleep on something. There was no such thing as beds or anything like that, or anything associated with beds, in as much as sheets, blankets, etc., pillows were concerned. They were simply, once again, bamboos. And these bamboos we had to hit with hammers, and they were split. Bamboos always split. That's the structure of bamboos as we found. We were quite inexperienced about bamboos, but we soon became experienced in that respect. And these bamboos were then were battened down once again on structures inside the hut, each side of the hut, leaving a pathway in between, which was an earth pathway. We would then construct, once again with bamboos, a type of framework. And on that framework, we would tie across the top of it these split bamboos, what was to become, for the duration of our prisoner of war, that was the type of beds which we would lay on. I would say here and now that in no way would anybody appreciate lying on bamboos in the jungles, etc., of Thailand, because they, in next to no time, those cracks became infested with bugs, bed bugs, thousands upon thousands of bed bugs. And they would breed like terrific amount of breeding amongst them. And at night time, when we would lay on these, we would be smothered in bugs all night long. And when you squash them, the smell from these bugs was like the smell of almonds, as we would know almonds in England, almond nuts.
Did they bite?
Yes, they used to live. They would suck blood from you, because when you squash them, then there was blood, which couldn't have been of a very good quality at that time, I assure you. But nevertheless, we did. I was still dealing with that type of sleeping, because we also got infested with lice, and lice would gather on our bodies in any part of the bodies, especially in the pubic areas and your hair. And as we had no shaving material or anything, we would try to, some of us anyway, would try with a knife, which would have to be a culinary knife, what one would use, a table knife, and you'd try and sharpen it up on anything, you could do a stone or anything, and have an excruciating shave with a dry shave. But a lot of chaps grew long hair and beards, and they used to become infested with lice. And so we used to, as we stood in coos, so we would turn around and de-lice one another. That was the sort of thing which derived from our bedding, where we laid in the bed. So we constructed these huts for other prisoners of war.
How was the camp laid out? You know, I mean,
the camp was laid out in an orderly fashion, I suppose, in as much as that all the huts would be in line with one another, and they would be formal, a rectangular, would you call it, that sort of thing, like that. So we'd have huts on one side of the camp and huts on the opposite side and at the end of the camp. And at the beginning of the camp, where the entrance of the camp would be a guard hut, where the Japanese, which we found out, we didn't know a Japanese really, from a Korean, but they turned out to be Korean guards who were subservient to their masters, the Japanese.
I'll come back to that, because that is very relevant. So they have the guard hut there.
The guard hut is there at the beginning of the entrance, obviously, that'd be at the entrance to the camp. There was also, we made a special hut on the on one side of the camp, of which the Japanese commandant, Saito, his name was Saito, and he was housed in that particular hut, which was a special hut.
Whereabouts was...
And I think that I can't honestly think that we constructed that hut. I think that was probably woodwork brought in, and that was done probably by some of the natives from close by Canberra.
Now, what about a hospital area or latrines? Other buildings?
Well, as time progressed, I'll just relate, first of all, on that, as I have said, this was to take in other prisoners. So, as we built these huts, we didn't particularly know what they would be used for, each hut. But there was one which was almost adjacent to the hut of which I referred to, where the Japanese commandant, camp commandant, would be housed. There was a small hut set aside, which as we progressed became a sort of a hospital hut. And when I say hospital hut, a little figment of the imagination, could it be construed to be a hut that one would associate with hospitals? It's simply a put-up hut of bamboo and attap. And as I progress, I will explain what happened in that particular hut. But it was during my time, if I may say.
Well, just with more about the layout, you know, were there any latrines?
Yes, we did have latrines. Now, latrines were such that there was a trench. And once again, our old friend the bamboo comes into this. And over the top of the trench were put these bamboos, leaving a gap between the bamboos, of which was our only means, of which we'd have to crouch down over that and use as a toilet. On these particular, they were not in any way a hygienic toilets, as we know. We also didn't have toilet paper, which, as you can imagine, didn't help that us at all. We would use anything, any leaves or anything that we could find, because we were deprived of all that sort of thing. That basically, I suppose, would be what the construction of the normal prisoner of war life.
What about washing facilities?
There was no washing facilities whatsoever. We didn't have anything as associated with hygiene, as I think I have already said this actually, but we in those camps there was no such thing as a bar of soap, a flannel, a toothbrush.
There was
nothing laid on like cold water or anything like that. Anything to do with that, perhaps I've missed out one thing which I can say. There was also, obviously, we got to be fed, so we had to make a hut for what we would call a cookhouse, of course. The type of cooking utensils what they had were a massive big drums. First of all, they appeared to be like drums that you would put either tar in or that sort of thing. There would also be like the Chinese wok, only on a much grander scale, or when I say grand, a larger scale. And that's what they used to cook the rice in, you see, because that was the basic diet for the prisoners of war, was rice. So that was that.